release, even though I read about it a lot. And the topic that I chose is not necessarily the most useful for you guys, because you are already conscious of many things. But I'm going to try anyway, and maybe you like it, maybe it deepens your knowledge. And the topic is basically Orientalism by Edward Said, who basically asked himself two questions. He asked, are there dominant perceptions and ideas and views of the Orient, which includes the Middle East and basically the whole region between Morocco and Indonesia, as well as the diaspora from that region? And he also asked, if there are dominant perceptions, how do they look like, and what function do they serve? That's the question that he asked, and I'm going to talk about that. Who is familiar already with Edward Said and his writing? Okay, three people, five. Okay, so if you guys get bored, you just leave or ask difficult questions, and maybe the presentation will be better then. So Edward Said, just a little background on him. He's a Palestinian scholar, one of the most influential academics of the 20th century. He went through the experience of being of the expulsion from Palestine in 1948, which the Palestinians refer to as Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. And he came from quite a bourgeois, well-to-do family, and was therefore able to study in the United States. And at some point he had a position in Columbia University, where he became professor of comparative English literature. English literature and comparative literature, I think both. And he wrote in the tradition, or say the field of post-colonial studies. And that is a relatively new field of studies, which emerged in the 70s, and Edward Said was certainly one of the motors of that field. And what they tried to do is to look at something that is very relevant to history, but which was hardly ever studied before, and that is the fact that most of the people in the world were subject to colonization. And they tried to study colonization and its effects, as well as the perspectives of the so-called subaltern, or those who were victims of colonization. And, hey guys, come in. These are my friends, they will very harshly criticize me at the end. So then Edward Said at the end of the 1970s, wrote his most famous book, which he called Orientalism. Now, until that time, the word Orientalism referred to the study of what is referred to as the Orient. And from now on, please imagine me doing this, so using quotation mark, whenever I refer to a cultural entity or a geographic entity, such as the West, or the Orient, or Islam, or Arabs. Because these things don't exist, they are all imagined. This is why, but it's kind of tiring to do this all the time, so you have to do that on my behalf. So the word Orientalism referred to the study of the Orient, and Orientalists were those who studied the Orient, so scholars who did so. But after Edward Said introduced the term became somewhat of a derogatory term, because now the word Orientalism, the way Said defined it, and that's the meaning that it has taken, for most people, is a discourse or a collection of ideas and perceptions and ideologies that coincide with particular vocabulary. So a discourse about what is called the Orient, that he calls Orient, and a particular kind of discourse, a discourse that depicts the Arabs or the Muslims or the Orientals as barbaric, authoritarian, misogynist, terrorists, irrational, and an essential threat to the West and the achievement of enlightenment and civilization. That discourse Edward Said referred to as Orientalism, and those who reproduce that discourse are therefore Orientalists. So if someone calls you an Orientalist and he has read Edward Said, you should not be happy about it. Now, in brief, I already answered the question somewhat that Edward Said raised. So what are the dominant perceptions? Well, these are the perceptions that I just gave you. And let me just show you a couple of pictures. Which is not to say that this discourse is only to be found in pictures, and I'll get to that later on. As you can see, these are sort of what is to us very familiar depictions of the Orient. You know, you have the sheikhs in the desert worshipping some kind of god, and there are the desert storms with the horses, and there is the Arab female, or maybe not even Arab female, but at least a female in an Arab setting that is some sort of object for the man, who uses that woman to be happy and be sexually aroused, and that woman is of course belly dancing and all that. These are sort of the depictions that we have, and these still exist and are still reproduced as though these images are still present in the Middle East. One could even question, were these images ever present in the Middle East? Probably not, most of them. These are a bit more modern images of the Orient. I mean, there are other images, but these images are very salient. You see them very often. You know, the bearded men who are angry at we don't know what, because that's hardly ever explained in the media, so they only seem as irrational, angry men who shout all the time. And then there's, of course, explosions and, you know, the seminal event of history, the 11th of September. Now, Edward Said's answer to the question, what is the function of these images, of that discourse that contains these images, is a political one. His idea was that this discourse, the Orientalist discourse, has a political function. It enables and legitimizes, and these are two different things, and I'll get to that later on. It enables and legitimizes the domination of the East, the Orient, by the West. So it is essential to how the United States treats Arab and how the United States and the West in general conquer and pillage places in what is considered the Orient. Now, let's talk a little about discourse. And I must tell you, I'm not an expert, again, on this field, so if you have additional things to mention, please do so. The simple understanding, perhaps to begin with, of the word discourse is maybe an ordered system of perceptions, views, ideas and ideologies, terms and concepts, right, that we use in order to give meaning to part of social reality. Right, so it's some sort of a lens, and when we look through that lens, we understand social reality in accordance with what the lens allows us to see, what the lens hides, and what the lens highlights. Right? Another, and I think is a better definition, is that a discourse is what defines social truth. So I'm not talking about whether or not snow is white. That's kind of physical. That's, you know, that's simple. But a discourse sets the boundaries for social truth. So it decides what we consider, what we can consider true, and what we cannot consider true once we accept that discourse. To give you an example, many people in the West, I think the majority, and luckily we are exceptions, think that the West, one way or another, even though it makes mistakes, and even though the West also has interests that serves itself rather than others, but in essence, the West is a power of freedom and enlightenment. It is something good. So when we think about foreign policy, for example, of the United States or of any other country, it is hardly likely that we will come up with ideas about that foreign policy that counter the belief that the West is absolutely good, which has, for example, as a result, that the dominant discourse in the United States about the war in Iraq is not one where it is argued the US attacked Iraq in 2003 and purposefully destroyed the country, because only evil powers do such thing. This is not what you hear in mainstream US media. What you hear is that many things went well, and the things that went wrong were accidents. It just happened. They were collateral damage. So something that is accidental, because the discourse that people have internalized is one where the United States is defined as a power of good. So this is how discourses function. Now, I won't talk about that too long now. Maybe one more example. So what is then the importance of discourses? If discourses shape to a large extent the way we think about the world, and if our thinking about the world, and I think that's, you know, that's not something that needs to be argued very much, if our thinking and our perceptions about the world decide how we behave, so decide to at least a large extent how we shape our world, then if we want to understand the world and want to understand, for example, policies or understand how society is shaped, we have to look at the important discourses in society. One could argue, for example, that because there is a particular discourse about the African in the West, it is very easy to organize mass hysteria that legitimizes and enables a particular war. For example, in Uganda, in order to catch Kony. The idea that we have of the African, and many studies have been done about that, is the following. Either African, that is black people from Africa, are villains such as Kony, or dictators such as Mobutu, that is, when his function as a big ally of the United States was over, he became a villain. Or they are helpless victims, you know, the kids with big bellies who die because they cannot help themselves. These are the two pictures that we have of the African. So it becomes then very easy, especially if you take into account that we have an assumed innocence of the white man. The white person is a good person who is responsible, and it is his white man's burden in order to help the African. If we combine all that, it becomes very easy to enable and legitimize a war in, for example, Uganda to capture Kony, but in reality to do other things, as you all know. Now, something very important to mention before I look a bit more in detail at the Orientalist discourse and its characteristics is the very explicit political nature of discourses. Discourses are produced only if there's a power, a political power, that enables that. And they always have a bearing on the political constellation and the power structure of society. So power and discourses, like power and knowledge, power and ideas, imply one another. And I'll talk about that later on a bit more. So let's move to the fun bit, where I show you some films and stuff. The characteristics of the Orientalist discourse. And I'd like to start with a film, and probably most of you have seen it. You don't dare to say yes, do you? Now, we can notice a few things about this film. Maybe you guys already noticed how the Orientalist discourse is at work in this little clip of Aladdin, something that all of us have seen. Maybe one of you wants to mention something that he or she saw.
Sure. The cutting off of ears because they don't like your face.
Yeah, exactly. That's
barbarism is mentioned.
Exactly. So the guy who is a jolly, happy little Arab, right, who is happy about his culture because he sings in a very happy tone, sings, I come from a land, from a faraway place where the camels in the desert roam, where they cut off your ears if they don't like your face. And then he admits, it's barbaric, but haha, it's home. I like it. I'm a barbarian, and that's why I like cutting off people's ears. And it's an Arab who says this. Now, there's more in that film. At the end, you see this little Arab guy doing this, right? So he is some kind of servant, okay? Another thing that you could notice is that the picture that you get of the Arab world is the traditional one of camels and deserts and the Arabian night and the Arabian, the one in 1001 night stories. By the way, 1001 Arabian Night stories, they're not an invention of the Middle East so much. They were compiled by an English traveler. And now even Arabs believe that it's a genuine Arab thing. Anyways. And did you notice the way he talks? Does he have an accent? He has an accent. What does that denote?
It's very funny, actually. It's more like an Indian accent than anything else.
Yeah.
That's because of the American or English influence there.
Maybe. But what does the accent tell you in Hollywood movies, usually, when someone has an accent? Or very often, not all the time. He's not clever enough, and very importantly, he's not one of us. Because if he's one of us, even if he's a foreigner who's not able to speak Arabic, he will not speak with an accent. To give you an example, there's another film made by Disney about that period or something, The Son of Egypt. And as I will tell you later on, Israel and the Jews are considered very much part of the Western us. And there, the Jews don't have an accent. But wait a second, Jews and Arabs from the same region, they never spoke English, so if you're consistent, either they both have an accent or they both don't have an accent. You have to pick one, Mr. Disney. But they don't pick one. And the reason is very simple. Arabs are not considered part of the Western greater us, so they don't have an accent. And very often they are evil. That's another reason to give them an accent, because evil people have accents, like Russians. They have accents in films, like Mexicans, they have accents in films. Or like African Americans, they have very thick accents, even though they don't always resemble the reality. So these kinds of images is what Edward Said talks about. And there's something very important to note about this. Now remember, we saw this when we were children, even including myself. And we loved Aladdin, we really enjoyed Aladdin. I did so too, and Edward Said talks about that too. He watched Aladdin-like films from his time, and he enjoyed it. They are part and parcel of his youth memories. And something that is very important to remember about discourse is that very often our acceptance of discourse, or our internalization of discourses, doesn't happen in a reflexive context. And a reflexive / argumentative context. What do I mean? When you watch this film, you are not invited to think critically. You are not invited to question, because you are sitting and you are enjoying a funny song and a funny cartoon, and you're following the story. That's what you're focusing at. And you're only using your so-called critical faculties in order to follow the line of the story. That's it. In the same time, you are hearing and understanding the message, right, of cutting off people's ears, the accents, and the images that you see. And you are absorbing these images very easily, exactly because you are not thinking, exactly because this film places you out of a reflective context. This is why religious organizations, I hope I don't offend anyone, I just don't like religion, religious organizations, they love to use songs, they love that. And these songs are about God for the same reason. When you listen to a song and you like the melody and you like the beat, then you are not in a reflexive context, and it's very easy for you to accept the ideas that that song communicates. And most of this Orientalist discourse is communicated exactly in this way, and I'll give you some more examples. Chuck Norris doesn't push up, he pushes the ground down. Hollywood movies, many of them, end with piles of dead Arabs. Now, why? Orientalist discourse depicts Arabs as the arch enemy of the West. In fact, the Arabs are presented as the quintessential opposite of the West. Whatever the West is, the Arab world is not, and the other way around. So the Western world is enlightened, the Arab world is irrational, the Western world is democratic, the Arab or Oriental world is authoritarian, the Western world respects human rights and the rights of women, the Arab world is misogynist, etc. And another important thing, because they are an enemy, it is legitimate to kill them and not ask questions about it. And therefore we see that Chuck Norris on his own, because the West is also more advanced and stronger and more courageous, whilst the Arab world are not to be trusted people and they are cowardly and you have to treat them with violence because that's the only language they understand. This is why Chuck Norris so easily kills all these people, and this repeats itself. Now obviously one of these films doesn't cause a widespread orientalist discourse, but it's the repetition of such images in almost every case where Arabs or the Orient is depicted. This is why there is such an orientalist discourse, and it is so strong and dominant. Now, so this is one part of orientalist discourse, that the Arab world or the orientalist world is the opposite of the West, and it's the enemy of the West. Another thing is, orientalist discourse is essentialist. What does it mean? You know what an essence is, right? An essence is a characteristic that is in the nature of the thing that we are characterizing, and that doesn't change. It is timeless. It is simply part of the nature of something. And the view that orientalist discourse takes on the Islamic world or the Oriental world is an essentialist one. They believe that Muslims or Arabs or Orientals have particular characteristics that are unchanging, as though the Arab world has not changed since more than 1,000 years. So the idea is they have been always barbaric. And I'll give you some examples. You're familiar with Samuel Huntington's work, probably, The Clash of Civilization, that conquered the world. This is exactly the view that he presents. He says that the Arab world has particular characteristics, these have always been so, and the Western world has other characteristics, and they clash necessarily on the basis of these characteristics. Let me try to find a quote of that. So Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington are very big American scholars. They have occupied positions in government at top levels, as well as in very prestigious neoconservative think tanks. And this is stuff they say. So Lewis says, in a sense, they, the Muslim or the Oriental world, have been hating us for centuries. Remember, they have an essence. So it's always been like that. You have this millennial rivalry between the world religions, and now from their point of view, the wrong one seems to be winning, which is the West. And more generally, I mean, you can't be rich, strong, successful, and loved, particularly by those who are not rich, not strong, and not successful. So the hatred is something almost axiomatic. Again, the essence of the Islamic world is to hate. The question, and this is terrible, the question which we should be asking is, why do they neither fear nor respect us? So Lewis, and remember, this is an academic text that is taught to people going to Ivy League universities, the people who will later on take the decisions, right, about the world. He is asking the question, actually it's funny that they hate us, because we're superior, they should be fearing and respecting us. That is what he's saying, and this is an academic. This is how far Orientalism goes. Okay, another characteristic of Orientalism, it is its cultural reductionism. When Orientalists study the Arab or the Oriental world, they don't ask the question that we usually ask about people when we want to try and understand their behavior. Usually we look at things such as the economic position, sociological characteristic, the political context, etc. But when Orientalists look at the Arab or Muslim world, they only look at the culture. And it is as though the Arab culture, and currently in modern Orientalist discourse, it's Islamic culture or the Islamic religion, as though that explains everything about Arabs. So whenever they do something bad, it's because they're Muslims. And whenever they're unable to do something good, it's because they're Muslims. And a very good example of a great Orientalist in our society, and I love the man because he's such a great example, is Geert Wilders. You know what Geert Wilders said, right, about Moroccan youth on the street. He calls them Moroccan street terrorists, by which he implies that their unsocial behavior is the result of their culture. Because we all know what the word terrorism is associated with. It's associated with Islam. So when you call someone terrorist, then that person is Muslim, especially if you mention that that person is Moroccan. So it's as though Khalid Wildes is telling you, these kids bother young girls, you know, by saying, psst, hey, meisje, alles goed, and that kind of stuff, not because they grow up in bad neighborhoods where the government hardly invests, not because their fathers have been brought to the Netherlands and have been marginalized for decades and at some point they were jobless because we restructured our economy in the 1970s, not because the educational system is racist. You know, if you have the same CITO score and you're a foreigner, then you go to a lower high school. This has been proven in research. It also happened to me and many of my friends. And when you're white and you have the same CITO score, you go to a higher position, and usually you stay within that position. I was sent to MBO, MAVO, even though my CITO said half of MBO. That's not a coincidence, I later learned, when the Municipality of Amsterdam did a research on that and saw that this was structural. And my teacher was convinced that I was not able to do better. But later on I studied political science and I graduated cum laude. He didn't believe that. And this is something you can tell if you're a good educator. But because I'm an Arab, the story changes. So this is cultural reductionism. And this is actually where racism in Orientalist discourse becomes most manifest. Because even though Geert Wilders and all these other Orientalists use the word culture, the way they use it in terms of the structure of the arguments they base on it is exactly the same as the word, as in the case of the word race. They only use the word culture now. Replace the word culture or religion or Islam in Geert Wilders' discourse with race and it would all make perfect sense. Because what they basically are saying is that the essence of Muslims is to be criminal because they are Muslims. And when we want to understand them, we understand them as a race, as a culture, not as normal people who are subject to socio-political circumstances, which might lead them to doing things that we find not so desirable. Two more characteristics. The idea of Orientalists is about cultures, is that cultures or civilizations, as Samuel Huntington says, are monolithic entities, right? So there is only one type of Western culture, and that is democratic. Anything else is not really Western. And there is one type of Islamic or Orientalist culture, and that is authoritarian and barbaric, etc. So the idea then becomes, as Geert Wilders also brilliantly can argue, is that Bin Laden is the sole representative of the Arab world, right? And this is just as ridiculous as saying that George Bush is the sole representative of the Western world. The idea of Edward Said is that collectivities and civilizations, right, are not unitary and monolithic. They are contested all the time. Because since we have accepted, as Edward Said does, that perceptions shape our society, etc. Therefore, there is no such thing as a true American or a true Arab. These two are constructs. They are constructed in discourse, and they are constructed for political reasons, as you all probably know. So, then in an Orientalist discourse, when saying that Bin Laden represents the Arab world is basically negating that collective identities are always contested and that it's a matter of power, not a matter of essential nature. What I use as an example sometimes is this. It is as ridiculous to believe that Bin Laden is the representative of the Middle East as to believe that George Bush is the one. And it is also ridiculous to believe that all Americans adhere to George Bush's ideas about the American collective identity and not permit those who are less salient in terms of defining the American identity to also be part of it. To give you a nice example that I like, who knows Badr Ali, the rapper? Alright, I'm glad. Only two? That's really bad. You're so white, guys. So Brother Ali has this brilliant rap, and Brother Ali doesn't represent the majority of Americans, but he is one who is also trying to contest the American identity. And he raps this. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the brave. So not land of the free, land of the thief, home of the slave. So not land of the free, home of the brave, as the mainstream Americans think. A grand imperial guard where the dollar is sacred and power is God. And then he moves on to include the history of slavery into his identity, which is very often negated, right, by mainstream American ideology. And he raps, almost bow to the fat and lazy, the fuck you, obey me, or why do they hate me, who me? Only two generations away from the world's most despicable slavery trade, pioneered so many ways to degrade a human being that it can't be changed to this day. Legacy so ingrained in the way that we think we no longer need change to be slaves. Lord, it's a shameful display. The overseers, that's the slaves, got even raped along the way. And the children can't escape from the pain in their veins, and the children can't escape from the pain, and they're born with the poisonous hatred in their veins. Try and separate a man from his soul. You only strengthen him and lose your own. So shoot that fucker, such as George Bush, if he walks near the throne. Remind him, this is my home before I define how it looks like, and not only you, Mr. Bush. So identities are always contested, but oriented. They don't recognize that. They think Muslims are bad and Muslims are good, and that's it. Okay, I want to show you. Oh, I missed that. There's an important point that Edward Said tries to make. His idea is not trying to show what the Middle East or the Orient actually is, and that it is misrepresented, and therefore he wants, through his book, to show what it really is. That's not the point to him. His point is not to show to what extent Orientalist discourse corresponds with the reality of the Orient. What he tries to study is, in what ways is the Orientalist discourse formed and is consistent with itself. Sometimes he might use evidence that shows that Orientalist discourse is not correct, but that is only to show that Orientalist discourse is not based on how reality is like, and not based on what the reality is of the Middle Easterners or the Orientalist, but it is based on the power and necessities or the need of those who create the Orientalist discourse. And that need is to find a way to subject the Orient to the power of the East. So if you want to understand Orientalist discourse, you have to study why it is created and what the purpose is of it, and not so much study how the Middle East actually looks like. That's what Edward Said tells us. Are there questions at this point? Not yet. Now, one more quote that I want to highlight. Orientalist discourse is not only to be found in popular media and in movies and rap songs, etc. Right, another rap song, by the way. Remember Bombs Over Baghdad by Andre? Can you imagine Andre rapping Bombs Over New York? He'd certainly be sued, but because of Orientalism, he can just say Bombs Over Baghdad. That's okay. Orientalism is the dominant discourse in Western academia that tries to understand the Orient. And here's another one of my favorite quotes. There as elsewhere, that is in the Orient, the fear and envy of America are based less on American actions than on the kind of projection. So the reason why people envy and hate the United States is not because the United States bombs the shit out of Iraq. That's what he's saying. The expectation that America will act as they themselves would act if they possessed American power, that is what the hate and envy comes from. So what Lewis is basically telling you, right? We are Americans and have lots of power, the greatest power that history ever saw, right? But we are good and we don't bomb people. Mm-hmm. However, other people are essentially bad, especially the Muslims. Therefore, when they try to understand America's position in the world and they see that it has so much power, they will project themselves on America, and them being bad will expect that the United States is a criminal state. Right? So they hate us not because we bomb them, but because they are violent themselves. Brilliant. I really love it. He's such a brilliant man. Okay, so this is kind of Orientalism, quickly then. Some important points to mention. The first one is this. Edward Said doesn't argue, because he's not a simplistic man, that all knowledge about the Orient comes from Orientalism. This is not the point that he's making. All that he is saying is that this discourse is so dominant that whenever you want to speak or think or engage with the Orient, you have to also engage with this discourse, because this discourse always has a bearing on how we understand the Orient. Okay? And this is important because it shows how powerful the discourse is. You cannot escape it. I'll give you an example. If I want to speak about Israel and Palestine, being an Arab, right? It's very difficult. I am not really given the right to speak, because as an Arab, when you speak about Israel and Palestine, you are not really trustworthy in the West. This is how it is. So even if I am not convinced by Orientalism, and even if my discourse is not Orientalist, I have to take it into account when I'm trying to make my point, because the way people look at me is through an Orientalist discourse, and the way people try to understand what I have to say about the Middle East is at least partly through an Orientalist discourse, which makes my position very hard and makes me lose power vis-a-vis, for example, someone who is perceived as being Jewish. Because if you're Jewish, you're part of the greater us in the West, and therefore it is easier for you to talk about Israel and Palestine. Okay? This is just one example. Another important point that Edward Said makes is that Orientalist discourse is cultural. It is deeply ingrained in the culture of what is called the West, right? So it is also part of our identity. It forms who we are if we grew up in the West, even myself. We are influenced by it. It tells us who we are as a collectivity. Like I mentioned in the beginning, a collectivity that contrasts with the collectivity of the East, right? So it's very hard to get rid of it because it defines who we are, and therefore also defines what our aspirations and goals are. Therefore it's so powerful. Now let's move on to a more important point. As I said, as Edward Said, and he's inspired in that by Foucault as well as by Gramsci, though they have both different views, but he's inspired by both of them, sees a very important link between power and knowledge, or power and discourse. Power implies discourse and the other way around, right? You need a particular position of authority in order to be able to produce or reproduce a discourse and be considered credible when people listen to you. You need to have that. In the same time, you will only have such a position if there is the discursive condition for it, which means if people have the right perceptions in order to perceive you as someone who is credit worthy. I'll give you an example of that. Flaubert, which is a French author who wrote from the Orientalist perspective, and who Edward Said quotes and studies a lot, and whom Edward Said, by the way, admires, given his literary achievements. Flaubert has a story where he talks about Kutuk Hanan, which is an Egyptian woman with which he has an affair. Okay, and in his story, Flaubert talks on behalf of Kutuk Hanan, so he represents her. She does not represent herself. He talks on her behalf, and he shapes our view of how she views herself. Okay, and he can do that because he has a powerful position. He is a white male belonging to a colonial power who visits Egypt and has the ability, therefore, to describe Kutuk Hanan and to talk on her behalf. Kutuk Hanan doesn't have that power. She cannot represent Flaubert the way he can represent her. And this is something that Orientalist discourse is based on. The West depicts the East, and the other way around is much harder. And in Orientalist discourse, therefore, those who depict the East decide how it looks like and make sure it is in accordance, that picture, with what they want to achieve. So where does then this Orientalist discourse originate? According to Edward Said, Orientalist discourse has existed for a very long time. Okay, but the moment in history where it becomes, you know, it gathers clout, so to speak, is related to colonialism in the 19th century. And he takes us back, maybe I have a picture of that. You know this probably, right? It's familiar to you?
Napoleon in Egypt.
Yeah, exactly. It's Napoleon arriving in Egypt. Okay? And when Napoleon arrived in Egypt, he did not arrive with only a military force carrying arms. He came with an army of so-called scientists, philosophers, biologists, language specialists, anthropologists, etc. And their aim was to conquer Egypt mentally or intellectually. That is, create an image of Egypt that allows its subjugation to the French colonial rule. Okay, so Orientalist discourse is based on the European, or its origins are based on the European need to create an image of the East that enables its domination. Okay, this is why it has been produced, and at some point takes a shape of its own. Okay, I'll give you a very nice quote. You know Joseph Conrad, maybe? Oh, I'm sorry. Joseph Conrad wrote Heart of Darkness, and Heart of Darkness is, although it doesn't mention so, doesn't say so in the book, is about the colonization of Congo, which is one of the most brutal forms of colonization that we have ever witnessed. And the effects are still noticeable, right? Since 1998, between 3.7 and 7.3 million Congolese have died because of the conflict that we, as Western powers, have instigated there. And Joseph Conrad writes this: the conquest of the earth, so colonization, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it, so what makes it all right, what makes it okay, what legitimizes it, what redeems it is the idea only, an idea at the back of it, so an idea that is always present in the background, whether you notice it or not. Not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, something you can set up and bow down before and offer sacrifice to. Okay? And basically what he is describing here is la mission civilatrice of the French. I don't know how the English call it. They considered themselves to be the advanced nations, and other nations were not advanced, they were barbaric, and therefore it was okay to go there and take their land under the guise of, you know, advancing the progress of humankind or something. And obviously that bowing down before and making sacrifices to doesn't only entail the sacrifices that the people of Egypt, for example, or the people of any other country who were colonized have to make, but also the sacrifices that the French soldier has to make once he goes there. You die for the nation of France. You kill others, even though it's disgusting, for the nation of France. It's because it's something you can set up and bow down before. This is what Orientalism is about. Now, Edward Said also writes about Orientalism Now, and I wasn't able to download that film, but I can tell you about it. And I'll highlight a few things. And this is my last point. Orientalism Now serves basically the same function, dominating the rest of the world. It's as simple as that. And so it legitimizes and enables wars in Iraq, wars in Afghanistan, and it legitimizes the illegitimate influence that the West tries to have in, for example, Egypt, and it enables the taking hostage of the Arab Spring, all these things. And one of the most important things about modern day Orientalism is the legitimization of American military force. The United States, as you know, has the biggest army in the world, and if we take China and Russia and some powerful countries out of the equation, then the US has more military power in terms of budget and firepower than the whole world combined. How do you legitimize such a thing? How do you legitimize that a huge proportion of American tax money goes to the American military? How do you legitimize sending people to Iraq and letting them die and killing others in the course of it? Well, you need to present a threat, and that threat is then the Orient. Now, why did I say the Orientalism doesn't only legitimize but also enables the domination of the East? Well, it's as simple as that, as simple as the following, actually. Because our perspective of the world, right, we will have particular options that we regard viable in terms of policy and in terms of behavior, whilst we consider other options impossible. To give you an example, no freak, not even the craziest politician, will ever think, given current discourses in the West, of invading Germany. You're not going to invade Germany. You don't do that. That's just not part of the options that we have. Even though we can think of many material interests and other kinds of interests to invade Germany. It's a rich place, they have lots of industry, their women are beautiful. No, I'm joking. I'm speaking on behalf of misogynist politicians. So this is not an option. However, when you present a particular people or a particular region as a region where people are not equal to the people of Germany, so it's not a big deal if they die, right? and people who are a threat to the West, it becomes a very viable option to invade those people and take over the countries. I'll get to you in a bit. So there is, for example, a military-industrial complex in the United States. We're familiar with that. And that military-industrial complex will function and will reap profits for those who benefit from it, regardless of where we have wars. So where can we organize the easiest war? Well, probably in countries that are in the mental orient. That's the place where you can have the easiest wars. To give you a final example, and maybe I do have images. Okay, never mind, it doesn't work. I'll just explain to you. Are you guys familiar with General Schwarzkopf, who led the American attack in 1991 in Iraq? And he was called the television general because he was on TV all the fucking time, okay? And there's this really famous film of his of about 40 minutes to 1 hour, which was filmed, I think, in their like main base, probably in one of the Gulf countries. And it was broadcasted on American television, complete, like all of it, on I think ABC, so a mainstream news channel. And there General Schwarzkopf talks for 45 minutes about the invasion of Iraq, about enemy territory. And he says, for example, at some point, so we are planning to move in there and we are expecting to find 200,000 Iraqis. And we will try to defeat them with mighty military power, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. And at some point, he shows a film where you see what the pilot in the F-16 sees whilst bombing a bridge. And before the bridge is bombed, an Iraqi man escapes in his car, and he calls that Iraqi man the luckiest man in Iraq. Look up this film on YouTube. It's very, very telling. Now, what do we see there? Orientalist discourse has enabled General Schwarzkopf to dehumanize the Iraqi and talk about them as one, enemies, two, people to be bombed, and not victims, right? So I'll show you a picture. We don't see these pictures very often that are related to Iraq. Yeah, that became a big scandal, but you know, at some point it was over. And these pictures of Iraqi children being bombed, we hardly ever see them. The idea that we get of the American war is that the Americans were there with smart precision bombs, trying to, you know, avoid killing people as much as possible. Now, this is exactly the picture that General Schwarzkopf was conveying, because he was only talking about military targets and talking about tanks, not people who were dying. And this is usually how the US media covers the Iraq wars, you know, since 1980. You know, that's the first Iraq war that the Americans were involved in. When this luckiest man in Iraq passes the bridge and the bridge is destroyed, Iraqi infrastructure is destroyed, all those peasants in the room start laughing. Luckiest man in Iraq. Would such a thing be possible if we would talk about someone who just left the building before before the planes landed in the Twin Towers? I don't think so. Why? Because we consider them human, and therefore we treat them as such. However, due to Orientalist discourse, Arabs have been dehumanized, so it's easy to conquer and kill them exactly the way Chuck Norris did. Of course, when you ask someone who has internalized an Orientalist discourse, do you think Arabs should be second class? Do you think we should dehumanize Arabs? That person will tell you, oh gosh, of course not, right? And why is that? Because that person at that point in time will be in a reflexive context, and that person knows you should not kill people. But once the American government tries to organize mass hysteria to legitimize a war, and usually they do so by providing non-reflexive context, right? Then that person will buy into it, and at some point will tell you, yeah, we have to defend our interest, which means that people will die. That's just part of the game, okay? That's it. That's all I have to say. I hope it was useful to you. And now we can have a discussion. Thanks. I was actually planning to see if there were questions, and there are a couple, and maybe I can help you with that. And also, I was planning to have a little discussion with you guys. on how we, and with we I mean, you know, people in this room who try to make the world a more just and equal place, how we should deal with the dominant discourses in society and what we try to do about it, because I'm quite critical personally about how we go about handling the dominant discourses. And I think if we don't find a good way of dealing with these dominant discourses, such as Orientalism, but also the discourse about capitalism, of neoclassical economics, right, where we are taught if someone is poor, then it's his or her own fault, and not the fault of the structure. I don't think we deal with that in a very good way, because we don't take into account how people have been socialized, how they have been formed as subjects due to their because of the discourses that they have internalized. So let's start with questions. You were first, I think.
Well, the question, I'd like more like a second example, because I think when you say like Germany is not really an option to be invaded, I think for instance with Greece, I think it's a bit of an example like what happened to the Arab world, or however you want to call it. That in Greece also it is more and more a legit question also to send like a European police force or whatever into Greece, because they're also not accountable for their actions anymore, and they're not responsible and blah blah.
It's a garlic nation.
Before, you know, if I look back at how I perceived, for instance, Greece, it was like Spain and Italy, it was part of Europe, while now they're more and more pushed like into some kind of an exit situation where they're, other people.
Good point. It's the same structure, basically.
But I do have another question, because, for instance, with this Disney video you showed, when I think of these kind of things, it's the people who made it probably not aim at reproducing this kind of Orientalist approach. They're making a video that they perceive as enjoyable for kids, and I don't know, they're trying. You know, their aim is not to subject the Arab world or the Middle East or whatever.
I totally agree. Most people who reproduce this kind of discourse have no direct interest in the military-industrial complex, for example. But because they have been socialized like that, once they think about how to depict the Middle East, then the images that I showed you are the first to come up, so not these.
And if they want their products to be selling good, because they are working in a commercial environment, they tap into fuels that sell well. And anything that's opposite of like mainstream views won't sell well, so Disney won't be making that.
Exactly, even if they wanted to be different, it's very hard because it won't sell. Okay, I saw a comment in the back, and I'll get to you guys. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so we were talking about the book in the beginning, and I was wondering which
Clash of Civilizations?
Clash of Civilizations, which you would advise me to read for us.
Right. There's a film on YouTube, which is an interview with Edward Said, and the film is called Orientalism as a Tool of Colonialism. It explains basically exactly what I told you, but they're much better, because it's the man himself. And what you could read, of course, is the book Orientalism itself, which is a tough read. It's not easy, but I still recommend it. These are the two things that I can mention from the top of my head. From the top of my head. Yes, go ahead.
I was wondering, because you keep talking about Orientalism and how we perceive it as the West, per se, but in many oppressed groups, the group itself starts to believe and have the same ideas about itself as what has been portrayed on it, and I was wondering, in what aspects does the Orient take these ideas and have the same ideas by itself?
That's a very important question. Obviously, the West is the most powerful, say, political economic constellation that we have now. So when the West produces a discourse, it's spread all over the world. I mean, how many of you, and probably even us, we have seen more Hollywood movies than Arabic movies. That's one reason why this discourse spreads even to the Middle East. And you see very